Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on deliberations today before the United Nations Security Council, where a majority of the council, led by Secretary of State Clinton, have drafted a resolution calling for the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad to step down from power. Veteran UN reporter Ian Williams joins us. He is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, and we will discuss if, how, and when the UN will overcome a veto threat from Russia and China and take action to stop the killing in Syria. Then, as civil war in Syria intensifies, a Syrian-American sociologist who is a professor emerita of sociology at Simmons College in Boston, Elaine Hagopian, joins us to provide an analysis of the forces arrayed inside and outside of Syria. We will discuss how the Saudis and Qataris are arming and training the Syrian opposition in an effort to shape the outcome of the Arab Spring that protects their regional interests and feudal regimes. Then finally, the country's leading non-Mormon expert on the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints joins us to discuss Mitt Romney's religion and the effect that it and the Mormon Church's hierarchy might have on a Romney presidency. Jan Shipps, a professor emerita of history and religious studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, joins us. Her books include Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition, and Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Amongst the Mormons. Joining us now is Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist and author, as well as a senior analyst on Foreign Policy and Focused. He writes for Salon and Alternet and is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginners, The Arms Trade, that's ALMS, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History. His blog is Deadline Pundit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Williams.
Hello, Ian. Hi.
And when I say you're a veteran UN correspondent, do you want to tell me how long you've been covering the UN?
Oh, I'd rather not. 1989, when I first came to New York. So I'm now on my fourth Secretary General.
I see. Well, tell me about what happened today, because I understand starting yesterday, Hillary Clinton was there and the majority of the UN Security Council have drafted a resolution asking the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad to step aside, and the Russians have threatened to veto this. And I believe today they've spent the entire day trying to persuade the Russians to get on board. What's the latest?
Well, the last count that I saw was that there were 9 positive votes for the resolution. The resolution, by the way, is under Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, which means it is not enforceable by military means. For that, you need a Chapter 7 resolution. And obviously, the powers that drafted it, the Arab League in the West, did so with an eye to Russia to make sure that things, to allay Russian suspicions. But the whole situation is extremely complicated, and there's some justice on all sides. I mean, yes, Assad is a dictator, and yes, he's killing his own people. And he probably does not have the support of the majority of Syrians, but he does have the support of a significant minority, especially his significant minority, the Alawites. But then, you know, there's the other complications, is that Syria is a frontline state with Israel, so there's some reluctance for anyone to authorize a military assault, which would that the Israelis might take advantage of. And then there's the whole issue. For Russia, and India and a few other countries, the question is they always put themselves in the shoes of the target. And the question is, if they do that to them, will they do it to us? So, you know, throughout the last part of the 20th century, Russia was behaving in Chechnya with every bit as much brutality as as lots of it in Bosnia, but nobody said a word. It was an internal matter. Despite all the stuff about responsibility to protect, we saw that the King of Bahrain got away scot-free. And you have to get that conjunction of planets in the sky. Like, Gaddafi was incredibly unpopular and nobody cared. And the Russians were totally disingenuous because, of course, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, had actually been the UN ambassador throughout the Iraq war. And he knew what was going to happen when if Russia didn't veto that. But they were concerned to get rid of Gaddafi, and also, presumably, they knew he was, his number was up, and they wanted to carry on selling weaponry and buying oil and doing all the other things with the income of. So they did not strenuously oppose the resolution. In the case of Syria, it is more complicated for all of those reasons. The Russians want to carry on selling weaponry. They're also showing signs. Lavrov, who I mentioned, is in Australia this week. According to some reports, he's dodging calls from Hillary Clinton. Sergei Lavrov is a fluent English speaker, by the way. Suave, sophisticated, cosmopolitan, knows the world, and also is very conscious of the humiliations that the Americans have heaped on Russia over the last 20 years.
But surely, Ian, he works for Vladimir Putin, who's the boss now. This is not the Medvedev period anymore. And Putin is clearly soured on the West, he's up, and the West have soured on him. You know, he's a sort of KGB gangster running KGB Incorporated, and I don't think there's any illusions on any side. So I think pretty clearly, the arms deal is a big part of this. Because it represents, I think, some $4 billion, the most recent arms deal involving jet fighters. And Russian investors have put, invested in Russian businessmen have invested about $20 billion in Syria. So when Russia and China say that they don't want this resolution to go forth, to ask Assad to sit down, they want to foster dialogue within the country. But God's sake, it's too late for that because of Bashar Assad.
Of course it is, yes. But I mean, we have to remember that this is a complex process and they're playing to a gallery. So by playing it the way they are, they can get South Africa on side because South Africa is not happy with the West. There's a period with Kofi Annan and others where South Africa was in favor of the responsibility to protect. It joined in over Sudan, for example. And that's it's pulled back since then. And so has Brazil. And a lot of this is down to the arrogance and clumsiness of American and Western diplomacy. I mean, most of the time, all the Russians wanted was a little respect, and they were treated as defeated victims at the end of Perestroika when Gorbachev went. They were very, very cooperative. They weren't beyond the call of duty. And so in addition to all of those sordid economic details you mentioned, which have a part, there is also this persistent feeling of humiliation that, you know, they were a great power and they were treated like that. And they look at themselves, they say, excuse me, you have 9 people in support of this resolution and you say this means that we should go with the flow. A few weeks ago on Palestine, we had 14 members of the Security Council and the Americans vetoed it. So how can we have to go with the flow when there's a bare majority? And you don't have to when we have an overwhelming majority. And, you know, that's the type of stuff that plays out to the Third World Gallery, because they're looking and saying, yes, you want to deal with Syria. So if Syria, then why not Bahrain? No, in fact.
Right. You know, or Palestine, yeah. So again,
or Palestine, especially right. Palestine. I mean, yeah. that's American diplomacy, as long as Israel gets a free pass, is never going to have much in the way of credence in most of the rest of the world. And
but Ian Williams,
Morocco is the Arab member who's just sort of representing the Arab League pushing for action. Morocco is still occupying Western Sahara 40 years after resolution has told it to get the hell out of there. So, you know, the question, once again, is, you know, hypocrisy is not a sound basis upon which to build, an ethical foreign policy.
Yes, but Ian Williams, again, veteran UN correspondent, the Arab League, of course, have preceded this UN resolution and failed. They sent in an observer mission. That was pretty unanimous, including Morocco. The Saudis and the Qataris have been pushing it. Iraqis have opposed it, but then they went along with it to try and compromise. They're clearly taking their instructions, or at least influenced by Iran, Algeria voted against it, but it was pretty unanimous. So we know that the Arab League's involved. And in fact, the guy that everybody thought was a total disaster, the head of the Arab League delegation, who himself apparently perhaps involved in war crimes in Darfur, he has gone public, and a report of his has been leaked to Foreign Policy in Focus, where he says that, you know, the Arab League monitors were a total joke. They were not qualified. Some of them thought they were going to Syria for pleasure. That's been a complete catastrophe, which has led to this situation now in the United Nations, right?
Yes, and you know, the Arab League has never been an impressive body. A former ambassador from the Arab League to the UN once explained to me why he had such flowery, wonderful rhetoric. It was because it was disguised as a lack of substance. He says, I can't speak on behalf of the Arab League because whatever I say is going to be contradicted by half of them at any given moment. And, it's the fact that with the changes, it's actually coming out sort of almost shooting from the hip. Still, remember, one of the most powerful members of the Arab League is Saudi Arabia, where, you know, executions, repression, and complete denial of human rights, let alone women's rights, are accepted by us because they're our allies. And, it highlights the hypocrisy of all of this.
Well, our next guest is coming up after you, Ian Williams, is going to be talking about the subtext of why the Saudis and the Qataris are arming and training the Free Syrian Army, that they want to shape the Arab Spring to maintain their feudal regimes. Just in terms of...
Well, there's partly that, but also the geopolitics, remember, Assad has... although he's been getting supported by these Saudis financially and politically in relation to Israel, has been completely in bed with the Iranians for a long time in a geopolitical terms, which, of course, the Saudis, there's a whole circle of people with knives in their back, at each other's backs here. So the Saudis are unhappy with the Iranian connection and would obviously like a more pliable Sunni regime that they can deal with there. And they're even prepared for it to be democratic as long as they doesn't infect Saudi Arabia itself.
Well, Salafists, though. But I'm saying they're already Salafists fighting the Syrian regime inside of Homs and Hama, which would made into, you know, and you know that the Saudis have been supporting not with arms but with money, the Salafists in Egypt who did very well in the elections. So.
This has been one of the real problems with Syria is it does have quite substantial minorities between the Alawites and the Christians and the Kurds and others. And if this continues, then the last thing anybody wants to see is the sort of pogroms that happened in Iraq, where minorities were driven and those population shifts and. Once again, Assad will have some popular support because these types of minorities in Iraq, they tended to supported Saddam Hussein because he protected them against the majority in many ways. And a similar situation applies possibly in Syria with Assad. You know, he has looked after the Christians and the others there. So he's... there will be some support, no matter how passive for him. But the real problem is, as long as it carries on in this disorganized way, in the good old days, either the Russians or the Americans would have arranged a coup, and the Syrian military would have just moved in and shifted him. That's how it used to be done. But one of the things that happened is that the Al-Assads have packed all the higher echelons of the armed force and security forces with the family and members of the Alawite sect, which
Well, just in closing, then
made them a target,
right? Well, just in closing, Ian Williams, again, veteran UN correspondent, Hillary Clinton, of course, is saying it's absolutely imperative that we be on the right side of history and that the Syrian people themselves are the ones who are crying out for peace and justice, for dignity, for their rights and a better future. And whose side are you on? The side of a brutal dictatorial regime or the people? That's the way she's put it to the Russians. Now, I take it that this is going nowhere. No decision today. Just in the last minute, what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, there's a few to exit. I mean, the signals that are coming are mixed. This is a sort of game of bluff. It's quite possible that there might be, you know, there could even be a side deal involving Iran, that the Russians would support a stronger resolution on Syria if the West backed off on Iran and restrained Israel. I mean, all of these things are possible in this type of poker game that they're playing. And another possibility would be, if they wanted to send a signal, would be to pass a resolution referring this whole affair to the International Criminal Court, which would be a good way out. And it's happened before. It happened in Libya, and it happened. But then you have the complication that you're sort of not giving much of an incentive to Al-Assad to get the hell out if he thinks he's going to go straight to The Hague. You need a soft landing. I foresee a possible future for him in a retirement home in Riyadh, like every other Arab dictator.
Well, Ian Williams, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ian Williams, who's a veteran journalist and UN correspondent and author. He's a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus and writes for Salon and Alternet and is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginners, The Arms Trade, that's ALMS, Deserted, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History. His blog is Deadline Pundit. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back getting an analysis of the forces arrayed inside and outside of Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elaine Hagopian, who's a Syrian-American sociologist and professor emerita of sociology at Simmons College in Boston. She has an article at Counterpunch, Bashar Assad's Missed Opportunity, Syria's Pandora's Box. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elaine Hagopian.
Thank you.
And your extensive article at Counterpunch goes through the modern history of Syria starting at 1971, and it lays the groundwork for much of what's happening today. However, the notion in the article of Bashar Assad's missed opportunity, was there any way, given what you refer to as the Alawite Mafia, the sense that this family has treated a country like its own personal plantation, mm-hmm. was there any likelihood ever that he would not miss the opportunity?
Well, that in retrospect, because I wrote that article in June, it's probably true that he had, in essence, from those forces on him, he had no choice. But as in all things, you do have a choice. And his choice was that he could have come out in his public speeches rather than being sort of casual and talking about there will be reforms, you know, and then never producing them. In other words, I think he could have made a public statement and challenged the existing powers that be, both in the Ba'ath Party and the security forces, to really come around. There may have been an attempt to assassinate him if he did. The question is, will he last anyway? So does he have authority? Yes, I think he does, but I don't think that he is the total picture. In recent days, however, I think he has given in further and further to the powers that be and has become himself part of that structure in a way that where in the past I think he probably was straddling a line and was finding it difficult to go over to reform because of the forces on him, and on the other hand, towing the line for these people. Well, he needed to stop straddling.
Well, Elena Gurbian, obviously, when the people came out calling for reform, the response from the regime and the regime's thugs was to kill them, and thus the cycle of violence and, in effect, recruitment for the opposition began. But my understanding is that in terms of pressure on Assad, isn't some of it coming not from just his brother Maher, who's in charge of the Republican Guard, but also from his mother?
Oh, yes. There was an article that pointed out and said to him, you should be as strong as your father.
Who killed thousands of his fellow Syrians in Hama.
Maher, to me, is a very important figure. In some ways, he reminds me of his uncle Rifat, with whom Bashar's father, Hafez, had a lot of trouble. Rifat was a loose cannon, and he's somewhere either in London or Paris. He goes back and forth, also still trying to become the alternative to Bashar. But at the same time, I think the Western forces, particularly the United States, and also Saudi Arabia and Qatar and a few other of the Gulf nations, saw this protest as an opportunity to try again to, through one door or another, to break down that alliance between Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, the only alliance that has resistance, or at least alleges resistance, to the Western designs in the area. And I think that they played a role in now training the Free Syrian Army, which, by the way, many of those defectors of the Free Syrian Army are from the Idlib area, which is the Muslim Brotherhood area. And we have bases, U.S. has bases in Turkey, and, you know, there are indications that, you know, training is going on in Turkey. We also have special operation forces on the Jordanian border specializing in monitoring communications within Syria. So there was an opportunity. I think now as the Free Syrian Army and the rebels within become militarized, and the Syrian National Council, which has a lot of Syrian expatriates who live in the United States and Europe, and who WikiLeaks tells us that so many of these exiles were cultivated by the U.S., is trying to say that they basically are in charge. They have now offered to help the Free Syrian Army get arms and training. Question is, where do they get their money from? And we know also that the spokesperson, Burhan Ladioun, who is in Paris, stated that the council, should it come into power, would sever relations with Iran and Hezbollah, and would look for diplomatic means to work out the issues with Israel.
Sure. Well, but Iran is supporting Bashar Assad. They've exported the Revolutionary Guards and the Basij militia to help train the Syrian thugs in killing their own people. So I can't imagine why they wouldn't cut ties with Iran. But first of all, let me just reintroduce Elaine Hagopian, who's a Syrian-American sociologist and professor emerita of sociology at Simmons College in Boston, and she has an article at Counterpunch, Bashar's Assad's Missed Opportunity, Syria's Pandora's Box. My understanding, though, is that the United States has not been particularly interested, or they've been ambivalent for the longest time, that they've taken their cues from Israel, who've also been very ambivalent. There are very senior Israeli people calling for trying to make a deal with Assad while he's weak to shore him up, because they're more afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood than they are of this corrupt regime. And furthermore, I spoke recently with a former CIA officer who actually speaks Arabic, one of the few people in the U.S. government, Robert Baer, who knows the Syrians well, knows Hezbollah, knows all the players there, and was recently talking to the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, who he stayed in contact with, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, and they were complaining to him that the State Department wouldn't take their phone calls. And Bob said to the guy, well, you know, what are you going to do if you guys take over? And he said, we're going to kill all the Alawites. And Bob said, well,
that, of course, is a major, major concern.
Right. But that's when at which point Bob said to the guy, well, you know, no wonder the State Department won't take your phone calls, you know. So I'm not sure that the U.S. really has a policy here.
I think that in a sense we fell into it. At first, President Obama was hesitant and was simply asking Bashar Assad to enact reforms and so forth. And then he asked him to step down. And then Hillary went to the UN and recently. Today
she's having that meeting in the Security Council. They're trying to squeeze the Russians.
Yes, and she's trying to say we're not moving towards Libya, the Libya-type approach. At the same time, we do have people in Turkey and on the border with Jordan. The U.S. is not a disinterested party.
Well, it has a vast empire of military and intelligence assets. But
it's not going to. I mean, as Hamid Dabashi pointed out recently, you know, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, to some extent, Israel, but not so much in the Syrian case. And Qatar and many of the Gulf states, they attempt to micromanage the direction in which this Arab Spring is going. Now, you know, the U.S. has approached the Muslim Brothers in Egypt because they saw what the elections were like. There is no reason to believe that, as the Syrian National Council has developed and has members that are theoretically Muslim Brothers, that the U.S. Is not looking ahead in terms of if the regime falls, if Assad goes out, and we should also say that Assad is not necessarily the regime; he is head of it, at least allegedly. And they would have to do a lot more cleaning, and that would almost look like an Iraq type thing. But if the Syrian National Council or the National Coordination Committee for Democracy, which is in for Democratic Change, which is in Syria, and unlike the Council, is not asking for international intervention. The Council is, but if they do get in, the question is the United States just going to wait to see if they get in and the Muslim Brothers get elected, or are they going to try learning from Egypt to somehow approach these people? In a number of articles, especially those that come out of AIPAC, and this particular article by Seth Wickes, you know, they talked about the fact that the people in Syria, this is back in earlier years, are not open to approaches from the U.S. We do know that the U.S. supported exile expatriates. And so what this guy was recommending is to have more Americans, you know, to try to visit with some of the potential leaders of dissent in Syria and to try to convince them to come and meet with Secretary of State and basically, you know, sort of cultivate them. Well, those that remain in Syria, for the most part, and who are not influenced by the Council or the Free Syrian Army, do not want intervention. The Syrian National Council and the Free Syrian Army do want intervention. What that intervention means does not necessarily mean a NATO-type bombing, but it does mean some sort of other force that must go in there if they want to put a stop to this.
Well, already my understanding, Elaine Hagopian, is that the U.S. doesn't really have much on the ground, that the Turks are running the show, then they broke
the
with us.
The Turks are very much involved. But
the Qataris have put in a brigade that was put together in Libya.
And they're arming this.
I just wanted to let the audience know that this is the reality.
Yes, we know all this, but you know, the Qataris, who are they trained by? The Turks, they're very good. I mean, they are highly developed and so forth. They are cooperating with the U.S., and we do have bases in Turkey. Mm. And you know, you can't tell me our forces aren't in some way involved in this training.
I'm not trying to tell you that. I'm just saying that in this modern world of surrogates, we have Kenyans and Ugandans fighting for us in Somalia. You know, we're learning how to outsource. But just to touch on, because we're running out of time here, obviously a lot of people in Syria still are undecided. They're terrified that the country's going to turn into an Iraq.
Yes, they are.
Which is what the legacy of George W. Bush's Great Folly. Mm-hmm. So that's a big factor. But if the Israelis are saying that they still like to make a deal with him, I mean, is there any chance the Russians are backing him to the hilt and they're selling arms to him? Is there any chance that they can make some kind of deal that he hold on, or has it gone too far along? Because I know
I think it's gone too far. And let me just give a personal note here, just based on the history of Israeli actions. They are concerned about possible Muslim Brotherhood takeover. On the other hand, they have worked for years, many, many years, to try to either modify Syrian behavior or to change the regime. And if you look at the way in which they've activated the Israeli lobby, they helped to push through the lobby here, the Syrian Accountability Act, the 1559 in the UN, trying to tell the Syrians to get out of Lebanon, etc. So I think that the Israelis put out certain stories and can be very convincing. On the other hand, we don't know what they're doing behind the scenes. Certainly, I would say this as a closing remark, that the attempt now, whether it was so from the beginning or whether it developed as things went along, is certainly to restructure the Middle East and, in many ways, look at Syria and to fragment it, to make it a weak state, because indeed, even if a Syrian National Council bolstered by Turkey or the U.S. or anyone else, you have very strong groups in there. The Alawites, the Sunnis, the Christian, the Druzes, the Kurds, which you know would perhaps fragment, and it would be a very weak state, something like what Iraq looks like today, and that could be very chaotic and destabilizing. On the other hand, it wouldn't be a very strong area. So we need to keep our eye on this and. We also know that it is almost impossible at the moment to get a very clear picture of just exactly who is killing, who is pitting, how much on each side is this happening. It is a truth that the regime is brutal. It's also a truth that the opposition is not necessarily respected within Syria, those that are being put forward and given a lot of publicity. So one would have to say that, you know, it's a sort of a curse on both their houses. And somewhere in there is an authentic movement that somehow needs to coordinate better and reassert itself and move ahead.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Elena Gopian.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Elena Gopian, who's a Syrian-American sociologist and professor emeritus of sociology at Simmons College in Boston. She has an article at Counterpunch, Bashar Assad's Missed Opportunity, Syria's Pandora's Box. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with one of the country's leading experts on the Mormon religion. I love I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jan Shipps, who's a professor emerita of history and religious studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She is an American historian specializing in Mormon history, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century to the present. Shipps is generally regarded as the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Latter-day Saints movement, having studied the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints for decades. Her first book on the subject was Mormonism, the Story of a New Religious Tradition, and her latest book is Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Amongst the Mormons, in which she interweaves her own history of Mormon watching with 16 essays on Mormon history and culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jan Shipps.
I'm happy to be here.
And I recently spoke with a law professor who had real concerns, First Amendment concerns, about Mitt Romney's connections to the Mormon Church and its hierarchy. And he was arguing that because Mitt Romney is a bishop or even a stake president, he used the analogy of the Catholic Church, saying that that would be the equivalent of a bishop who would be reporting to Rome. And in this case, in Romney's case, a President Romney would be reporting to the Pope in the Mormon Pope in Salt Lake City and his College of Cardinals.
Oh, no, that is a mistake. A bishop in the Mormon Church, it's called a bishop because they were called bishops in the New Testament, but it's really being a pastor. And it's being a volunteer pastor, and being the president of a stake is it still a volunteer activity, and it is oversight to the he has oversight of several wards, a stake president does, but this is again a volunteer position. He is not and has never been what you call a general authority. A general authority is someone whose position makes him, and it's always a him because it always has to be a member of the priesthood, but they have, you know, it's priesthood of everybody. They have, those that are called general authorities, have responsibility for the whole church as opposed to a local area, and they do not answer the way they answer to the College of Cardinals, which would be the Council of the Twelve in the Mormon Church. They do not answer at that level.
And the prophet is the head of the church, right?
The prophet is the head of the church, and he has two counselors. Mm-hmm. So there are 15 people that would be parallel or something like the College of Cardinals, but this was not a position that had to report to the Council of the Twelve.
So, Jan Shipps, obviously we're having this conversation because Mitt Romney is likely to win substantially in Florida, and I think by most counts, this is the presumptive nominee. And in terms of his statements about separation of church and state, Jack Kennedy, before he became president, made a famous speech in which he reiterated his support for the First Amendment. And as you know, back then there was some anti-Catholic bigotry which he addressed. And what's curious about Romney is that there's been very, very palpable anti-Mormon bigotry amongst the evangelical wing, particularly in the red states, if you will. And his only statement on the matter of the First Amendment and his Mormonism, he basically was critical of the growth of secularism in this country and didn't take the same opportunity that Jack Kennedy took. I was puzzled by that. What was your response?
I was surprised when he gave the speech.
When he ran last time, yeah.
When he ran last time, 08,
right.
In the 08 campaign, at the speech where he did not have anything to say about people who were what they call nuns, people who do not have a connection to the church or people who regard themselves as more spiritual than religious. But I think that he didn't have the same realization that the attitude toward the Catholics had been so clear for so long. And I think that maybe Romney wasn't as aware of the need to reassure people that he would not have to answer to the Council of the Twelve.
Recently, he basically took the position that's popular amongst the religious right, and that is that there's a problem with creeping secularism and that there's a kind of anti-Christian bias amongst the liberal elite. Rather than take on the anti-Mormon bigotry that exists in amongst evangelical Christians, he seemed to try and he was trying to co-opt them or win them over or
something. Now,
yeah.
The fact is that the evangelicals, this is the attitude that Mormonism is not Christian on the part of the evangelicals, is really actually a post-World War II position that they have held and so strongly. And I think, at least in where I wrote about is Mormonism Christian, I think this is they were trying to till the same fields. They were making converts in the new suburbs of and the developments, the housing developments in the suburbs, and they had the same group of people that they were reaching. And so the attitude that Mormonism is not Christian that was spelled out and was made such a big issue in the evangelical churches, in some ways, was the evangelicals needed something to be against because they were not all in one church. There were lots of different kinds of evangelicals.
Sure. Well, it is the fastest growing church, I believe, in Mormonism, isn't it, in the country?
If you want to talk about a single institution, you can say that Mormonism, since the Second World War, has grown very, very, very rapidly. But it has not grown as rapidly as, say, the Pentecostals and the Evangelicals. But the Pentecostals and the Evangelicals are not in one institution.
I see. But I think it is true, is it not, Jan Shipps, that the Mormon Church, on a per capita basis, is one of the wealthiest churches.
They do not make public their wealth, but most people believe that this is the case. But their wealth is in buildings and all sorts of, all over the world, they have used so much of their wealth to build temples all over the world and build chapels all over the world, where it was so expensive to do it.
Jan Shipps, again, one of the country's leading, actually foremost non-Mormon scholars of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. We're talking about Mitt Romney's, now that he's the presumptive nominee for the Republicans, his ties to the Mormon Church and the possible influence the church would have over him as a president, which has been overstated as we started out discussing. However, there is some secrecy, which I suppose leads to suspicion and charges of cult-like behaviors. I don't know that anybody, a non-Mormon, cannot see go into a service. That's what I understand.
Oh no, this is complicated by the fact that there are two kinds of Mormon structures. One is usually called a chapel. Some people call it a church, and it's where they meet on Sunday, where they have meetings all during the week and so forth, except on Monday nights, which is family home evening. And that is public, and anyone in the United States can go in and attend those services. The Mormon temple is understood more like a ancient Hebrew temple, and there are ordinances that are regarded as extremely sacred, and they are therefore private. People like to say secret, but it's really more private. Not all Mormons can even go into Mormon temples because you must have a bishop, that is your pastor's, recommend that says that your faith is strong and you must have paid your tithing in order to go into Mormon temples.
It's often been described as a very patriarchal religion. Is that the case?
It is a patriarchal and a hierarchical system as the institution operates from the top down. But at the local level, the hierarchy doesn't work quite as strictly as it does at the, you know, from the institution. When you look at an institution, how does the institution operate? And then you look at the local, and the local is much more open to people that are and might not hold particularly high positions in the church or anything. The idea is that each ward should only be big enough that everyone has a chance to serve. Everyone has a calling. And when the wards get too big, they divide them.
So let's talk a bit about their political influence. They're disproportionately, I think, in terms of the size of the religion, has considerable representation in the United States Senate. There are five Mormon senators, including Harry Reid, the head of the Senate. But they've taken a very, very conservative stance in politics. They essentially scuttled the Equal Rights Amendment, and they've taken it here in California. They funded Proposition 8, against gay marriage, etc., which is being overturned. So what is their relationship to politics, and how much does the tithing come in? Are they in a position to put money behind their conservative beliefs?
Well, yes and no. They don't put a lot of tithing money to support their positions. They ask for gifts from the membership to support their positions, or at least that's what happened in with regard to Proposition 8. And they did encourage, that is, encourage in the sense of suggesting that women not vote for the Equal Rights Amendment. The church came out against it. It's very rare that the church takes a really strong position on anything except things that they believe would hurt the family. And they were convinced, I think wrongly, that the Equal Rights Amendment would undercut the family.
Well, it seems like undercut the patriarchy. I mean, but that...
But they thought it would undercut the family itself. Mm-hmm. Mormonism is a family-oriented faith.
Well, now, its roots, I understand, you know, first of all, its roots are sort of like a lot of some religions have somewhat bizarre theological beginnings, and that's...
Let me say it this way. Mormonism started out as a cult, but so did Christianity. But when you can't tell a cult from the culture, it's no longer a cult. And that was true of Christianity, and it's true of Mormonism.
But it's in its early days, it met with a lot of hostility and moved from New York, I think, to Missouri, where, again, there were a lot of violence and prejudice against them, and they finally made their long trek to Salt Lake City. This may account for some of its sense of exclusion, if you will, because of the hostility towards it. But my understanding is that the polygamy was largely a result of the large number of widows. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. At least my interpretation is that the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith was very, very concerned with the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. And he talked first about the restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ, and then he talked about the restoration of Israel, that is, that everyone in the church was understood to be a part of the tribes of Israel, one of the tribes of Israel. They had, when they would get their patriarchal blessings, it would tell them which tribe and so forth. But then there is a third layer not just the Church of Jesus Christ and not just the restoration of Israel, but the restoration of the ancient order of things, which is a part of the third layer of Mormon theology. And I'm convinced that the prophet was more concerned to bring back the ancient order of things, and that he saw that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and, you know, Solomon and David and so forth all had multiple wives, and that was a part of the ancient order of things. The notion that there were just too many women is wrong, in the sense that it was announced in 1852, and at that time, it was publicly announced in 1852, but when they first went to the Great Basin, there were more men than women.
So, but there was a long history of hostility towards the United States. It was the last, apart from Hawaii, it was the last state to join the Union because they did not want federal jurisdiction. I think the U.S. Army was sent, I think at least on one occasion, to try and subdue them.
This is wrong to say they didn't want. They wanted to become a state. They tried to become a state. In 1852, they tried to, at the time of the Missouri Compromise, they tried to become a state, but the Missouri Compromise meant that they couldn't, even though they had enough people out there to become a state. They wanted to become a state. They tried again and again, so that the notion that they did not want federal jurisdiction is something of a mistake, because they tried very hard to become a state and finally managed to do so, but only after they gave up polygamy and after the practice of polygamy. They didn't give up the belief in it. They just gave up the practice. And only after they divided their parties, instead of having one single people's party, which was the Mormon Party, they had to divide into Republican and Democrat.
So Jan Shipps, again, American historian, is considered the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. I understood that after the Mountain Meadow Massacre that took place, where a wagon train of settlers from Arkansas on their way to California, I think, were massacred by Mormons, and at the time a huge national furor. And that the federal courts were having a hard time getting any jurisdiction to put anybody on trial.
Well, the problem was that when they made Utah a territory, they took the leaders of the church, made the leader of the church, Brigham Young, the governor and the Indian agent, and except for the judges, they had all Mormons as the people who were in charge, were in the civil authorities in the state. So it was, for a while, a theocracy, clearly a theocracy. But the Mormon War that started before the Mountain Meadows Massacre was when Buchanan decided to send federal troops out to establish a non-Mormon as governor. And that was already on its way, and the people who were... I mean, I've done a big study of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and the people who were there were afraid that the army was coming, and they were told that the people in the wagon train said they were going to California and bring back people to destroy the Mormons. These were people who had suffered persecution in Kirtland, Ohio, and Missouri and Illinois. And a lot of these people that were involved in the massacre were people that had been persecuted for a long time. And it was that they just said no more. I don't know. It's a very complicated story.
Well, suffice to say that the president of the United States, Buchanan, he was considered, I think he's still considered by historians the worst president in the history of the United States, and some suggest that maybe George W. Bush might be joining him, but that's another discussion. But just to touch you mentioned that they had to give up polygamy in order to become a part of the United States. Interesting enough, of course, Mitt Romney's great-grandfather left the United States because he was a polygamist.
That's right, and they went to Mexico.
Yeah, Miles Park Romney, the patriarch, he had took four wives with him and picked up another one. But interesting enough that the compound where they lived is still operating today, with a lot of Mitt Romney's cousins are there, including Mike Romney, who's gone a little bit public in some emails and stuff, and bears a striking resemblance. That colony down in Mexico does it still practice polygamy?
I'm not sure whether it does or not, but we do know that there are lots of Mormons who believe that God wouldn't change his mind, and that they believe it was a mistake to give up polygamy, so that you have a lot of modern polygamy.
Well, just in closing, Jan Shipps, you've said you studied it for 50 years. What is fascinating about this religion is, because it is a truly an American homegrown religion. I believe it believes that Jesus Christ came to the United States, or what was the United States.
They believe that Jesus came to the Western Hemisphere.
Right.
And that he appeared to the people who had come here, who had left the Near East, the Jews that had left the Near East and come to America, come to the Western Hemisphere, about just before the beginnings of the Babylonian captivity. So this would have been the kind of, the prophet was really interested in what the Hebrew religion was before the Babylonian captivity.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jan Shipps.
Well, it was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jan Shipps, who's Professor Emerita of History and Religious Studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She is an American historian specializing in Mormon history, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century to the present, and she's generally regarded as the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Latter-day Saints movement, having studied the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints for 50 years. Her first book on the subject was Mormonism, The Story of a New Religion Tradition, and her latest book is Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Amongst the Mormons. And that was a program that we recorded yesterday, but were unable to play because of the breaking news from the Florida primaries. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.